Thinking about the most elemental, perhaps, example of creativity and community. And I was remembering the ways in which my oldest daughter got out of the crib. She figured it out. So there's something about that that led me to think a lot of things about creativity and community, and that we all have creativity, and it manifests in different ways. And oftentimes, even if it seems transgressive, it still creates community or develops community in a way. So there's this balance between using creativity to communicate, to connect, to build networks. And there's ways in which we use community to push back against what we might see as injustice or inequity or just dysfunction. And the question is, how do we use creativity if we have a difference to get that, to get across the boundary and get heard and to see things change? And so what Michael was talking about is seeing a group of people develop a system where they're able to, you know, brainstorm and coalesce an idea that push back against the inertia of what was not functional for them is an amazing idea, amazing example of how creativity both creates community and pushes community not only to thrive but to transform itself into what could be better.
Well, it sounded like your daughter wanted to get out of the crib.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the problem, and she came up with a solution to solve it.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't necessarily to transgress the boundary of you got to stay in the crib. It was to connect with the family. Like, I'm in this room. You're in that room. I don't like that so much. So, yeah.
That's community right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You said something about brainstorming. And that's kind of my realm because I've done a lot of marketing. And we do a lot of brainstorming. And the biggest obstacle you face are people who say, well, that's not practical. Oh, you can't do that. And brainstorming and creativity and ideation is all about throwing it out there and looking at the impossible. So can't is a bad word. It's kind of yes, I can. Yes, we can. And then it's looking at those really crazy ideas. Like you think that your daughter's never going to get out of that crib, and she found a way. And it's the same thing when you're looking at community and solving problems. Also, I commend you, Michael, and your group and looking to the people who are most affected by this to come up with a solution. So not only did you come up with a really interesting solution, but they must feel so empowered to be part of that.
Now, I was thinking about the Declaration of Independence also, about the pursuit of happiness and how government is really for the people and then by the people. And that's, you know, a perfect example that Michael gave, and you too, Chris, is that you should be inclusive and involve if people want. And often you see a lot of people don't want to be involved in the decision making. That's why we vote and have our representatives do that. But you want to at least touch the people and say, do you want to be involved? And if you do, we're open to that. And I think each community is different. And I think Hudson has been growing for a long, long time, you know, over a century through different kinds of workforce development, poverty, growth. You know, everything is fighting, but it's like any kind of plant that wants to grow, it'll do its best. And so I like how we're a small city, only 6,500 here in Hudson, Columbia County. We're still growing, aren't we?
Growing, and we certainly have our challenges, but that's where the creativity becomes really interesting, because if you have new perspectives, and if you force people to think of things in a different way, then it can inspire a new solution. Because, I mean, I just read an article over the weekend about how Hudson keeps reinventing itself. So obviously we know a thing or two about creativity. The question is, how are we going to reinvent ourselves now? And I think it is going to take a group of people. I always say, if you want to supercharge creativity, you need diversity. And when I say diversity, that means diversity of age, diversity of ethnicities, diversity of race, diversity of life experiences. Because if you bring 10 people to a room and they all have very similar life experiences, you're going to get one or two ideas. But if you bring 10 people from 10 different walks of life, you're going to get at least 10 ideas, maybe more. And so I think that that's what's interesting now for Hudson, is that we do have quite a few challenges on our plate. Can we have some fun and find creative ways to solve them?
Well, when Tom, you were doing public art, as an artist myself, when I was seeing what you were doing anonymously, that was sort of something that made me feel good, that I saw some flow, some freedom that was happening. And for, you know, not knowing anything about it, I just thought that was cool. I like this place already. That's kind of, you know, you were helping to brand Hudson as a friendly, open place. I like that.
Well, it's good. I'm happy to hear that your takeaway was that, and that was your experience. I mean, that was, I guess, one of the maybe subconscious or unintended consequences of something like that. There were so many different things that went into sort of evolving that project. And one was the idea that, like in my experience growing up, we never really went to museums or galleries. And so those places always seemed very intimidating to me. And so my thought was, is that art should be everywhere. And everybody who has the desire to put art out should be able to do that. And so I thought of creating this, you know, public art project that would be a context within which people can appreciate art outside the boundaries of what one might normally think of as an art space, and where people could actually share their own art as well. And in some ways, in terms of creating community, I was trying to drop those boundaries that keep people separated from experiencing one form of what we put out as culture. And just to say, no, this is open to anybody who chooses to participate. The fact that it made the town seem more inviting and fun, I'm happy to hear that. I want to live in a fun place.
Yeah.
But it was more like a conscious effort to sort of break down the boundaries of, you know, like the stuffy white box in Chelsea where you walk in and they ignore you and you ask for a price and there is no prices because if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Will you talk more about one of the pieces?
Well, I did this project, I guess, starting about 5 years ago, and I called it the White Rabbit Public Art Project. And so I, you know, in my work, explored doing work with stencils. And what I would do is I would create a little piece with one of my stencils, and I would do it on cardboard or masonite, and I'd put it somewhere in town. So one February, I put a bunch of art with zip ties on the fence that is in Promenade Park overlooking the river. And people took it, which was one of the goals, is if you find it, you could either leave it, take it, move it. And it was kind of fun to see people finding things and then commenting on them in social media. But the idea was to put art where art is not normally seen. I mean, we have a really robust gallery scene on Warren Street. And if you go outside of Warren Street, like our gallery is on Green Street, and there's other galleries off of Warren Street. But in a lot of different neighborhoods, you're not going to see places where you can access art. And so I thought, you know, bring art to the people in a way.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I was mentioning to Michael the first time that he and I met was 10 years ago at Arts Walk, and you were a videographer artist. And tell me how that was during Arts Walk, and we had a show at the Cannonball Factory at that point. What's that? Remind us me what that video was.
Yeah, so I guess in the mid-2000s, I would go down to the waterfront and play soccer with mostly teenagers, but there was, I think there's probably people in their 50s and 60s playing as well, and there were people from all over the world. They were mostly Bangladesh, but I think we probably had three or four continents represented in probably 12 countries or something. You know, just be a pickup game during sunset at the park. It was a beautiful spot to play, and the city of Hudson actually cracked down and put up these signs saying that they didn't want soccer to be played at the park. Well, you know, what else do you want kids to be doing after after school? I guess it goes back to me being excited about sort of youth programs. This is sort of their own youth program of just getting together, playing sports. It was a very casual, fun game. Most of the kids played barefoot. And they're like, a lot of their families would sort of be walking around watching the game. So there's this sort of this whole community feel. It was actually the first time I went to City Hall was with them to push back and get the right to play soccer. And I really wanted to capture this experience of sort of this fight against City Hall, but also what I saw as sort of a more underlying challenge where I felt like they weren't being seen for who they were. And they were sort of being demonized either overtly or covertly for different reasons. But I saw them as sort of this beautiful group of people who were getting together to, play sports after school. And that seemed like a great scene. And I felt like it was also part of a larger struggle around like who has right to public space, who has right to sort of take up space in our city in a public park. So I had made this video about that struggle and then was excited to play it at some of these public gatherings that we had, like Arts Walk, which is also, a time for the public to gather. So I felt like that was a great opportunity to sort of show some of the conflicts that we were having around public space.
So you used arts and activism.
Yeah.
That's Chris, you were mentioning about the phrase you can't.
Yeah.
You can't do that. And I think Michael proved, yes, you can.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. I don't think there's any word more inspiring in the English language or any phrase than no, you can't. It brings up the rebel. It's our national history. We are a nation of rebels. And so you tell somebody you can't, and they very much are going to prove you wrong, as Michael did.
At the same time, it's so important to also be very overtly saying, like, another world is possible, and to sort of to believe and to, like, encourage other people to believe that, like, that we can do better, and that both as an individual and as a community, that we can sort of I think transcend was one of the words that you had put in creativity, and that, like, we can transcend this can't, and that we really do, we have the faith in ourselves and each other that we can do better.
It's coming up with the possibilities.
Yeah.
What is possible? And that begins a discussion, which is, a great opener. Well, what can we do? And, when I went to college to study photography, the very first class, because we were going to get into very technical stuff, the second class and on, but the first class was overtly about creativity. And visually, it was all about learning patterns, seeing patterns, envisioning patterns, and the teacher really made you go beyond the obvious. And I think that's what grew creativity within all of us as students, is going beyond what's obvious and looking beyond, because that's where a lot of great ideas come from, is going beyond the obvious and sitting down like we are and having a conversation, because we help each other think differently. That's a kind of our challenge, I think, here as a community, is listening.
Giving yourself the license to make a mistake is part of it too. The ability to, when you're putting new ideas out, it's scary. It's scary because you're doing something differently. Not everybody's going to get on board. And in your own mind, you can get paralyzed by this whole idea of, I can't do that. And you have to say to yourself, you know what? It's okay. Think of, we're creative in many ways. I mean, if you're in the kitchen and you're cooking and you're doing something completely different with a recipe you've cooked for years, and if it doesn't come out right, then that's okay. You have to say to yourself, it's fine. But if I do take this risk and I come up with something new, this could have really great, really great outcome. So the point of, like, just liberating yourself and saying to yourself, we're going to try something new. It's going to be a little bit uncomfortable. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, move on.
Kind of have to be open to therapy.
You might have to, yes.
And Michael, in your role as a supervisor, do you find that often where there's sort of a, it's always black and white, negative, positive? Or is there, do you see possibilities available?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of possibilities for improvement. I would say that's for sure. I think that, you know, nationally and maybe internationally too, there's actually, I think there's a trend to also be rethinking government in ways that do sort of invite some creativity. I think there's sort of been this tradition of you have these like departments and the department performs a function and it was sort of much more mechanized or much more like a factory, like an assembly line. Just like you do this, you do this, you do this. And we're finding all these sort of gaps. And I think the trend in government in general is that you have to have these sort of interdisciplinary or sort of like multimodal issues. So if you're thinking about, you can't be separating mental health services from economic development, from transportation, from physical healthcare, all those things are all related. And so you need to think about solutions much more collaboratively, where you have different departments working on things, but also you can't solve issues for a single individual. You have to think about these entire systems. And so I think when you get into those, if you start breaking things down and or combining things in much more complicated ways, I think it invites creativity, because you're one is that you're just doing something that you haven't done before. But also I think when you get onto these larger and larger systems, it becomes harder to think about them in the more traditional ways. So it sort of naturally speaks to sort of like, I have a brilliant idea that kind of cuts across lines, and that is maybe more based, that has some tying to like an abstraction or a trend or something that just feels like right for the moment. So I think that is going on a lot in a lot of places. And I think there are little pockets where that's happening here in Hudson and Columbia County. But I think that's like an opportunity or trajectory that we could be going in, that I think does tap into sort of design thinking and those kinds of ideas.
And I think it's okay when you create a law at that time, normally the majority says, yes, we need this law. And sometimes down the road, you find out that law doesn't work. And it's okay to...
Well, actually, attached to that, there's also a big trend to do pilot programs now as well. So actually, in the bus route we talked about earlier, that started off as a pilot program in the sense of it's... If it doesn't work out, we can always pull back. But like, how do you even approach policy and just be like, well, let's just try this. And is there a way to do something that you could always turn back and or change course? And so that way you also keep the creative juices always flowing, because you're like, we'll try this and now we're going to reassess and we're always sort of open to flux. And so I do think it's okay if things don't work out, because you learn from it. Just sort of like as you mentioned with cooking. If you can try something and it doesn't work, we can always change. And it'll be okay as long as it's constructed in the right way.
Yeah, I think sometimes people think, well, that's the end of that. My voice won't be heard anymore, and I hate that.
in business, we're using the word growth hacking, which is the idea exactly what you said, is you do something on a limited basis, and then you look and see, is this growing? Is this doing something for the business? Is it helping? And I think the obvious answer in the past would be, if yes, keep going. If no, stop it. But there's a middle step, which is, am I doing something wrong? Could we change this? Could we tweak this so it could work? And so you're absolutely right. I think in the past, government would start some big initiative, and if it failed, then you know we would lose that initiative for generations. Mm. Bike paths in New York City. You know, Mayor Koch initiated bike paths in New York City, and everybody loved the idea. But they weren't rolled out very effectively, and they didn't really succeed. And it took all the way until Mayor Bloomberg. You know, we lost several generations. Mm. And now bike paths are flourishing in New York City. And in fact, it's become a model for other cities. So, sometimes it's a matter of not just betting the farm on everything, but kind of taking that middle approach.
I love the cooking example, because I was gonna make a tetrazzini like I had before, and I was always kind of winging it, and I didn't have all the ingredients. So I decided to improvise because, and knowing that, you know, we can't afford to throw away food, so this better at least work. And it failed. It didn't look like or taste like what it was before, but then we had to kind of like therapy, let it go. This actually tastes good. It tastes different. You know, and having that freedom, and I think, you know, Tom's art recently been putting up new sculpture work, and it's like, oh, Tom, what are you doing, Tom? Oh, I like that. And so as an artist, you kind of learn to let go, don't you?
Well, there's a real challenge in for systems at every level, like even so as an artist, as a person, of letting go what seems to work. Because what seems to work, even if it's not fully functional, it's the devil you know. Mm-hmm. If you are on the edge of the unknown of change and experimenting or taking risk, it could fail or it could be a great success. And then you'd have to deal with both of those. And sometimes success is a harder thing to have to, you know, to deal with. Mm. But it's a real challenge, I think, that... I think as human beings, we tend to stick with these things that we know, that have function and have tradition, and we can't easily stand on the edge of the unknown and try new things. And so, like the sculptural things that you're talking about, you know, I have a lot of salvage material from various jobs, and just I like picking up really cool old pieces of wood and metal. But I was doing those types of things 20 years ago when I was doing a lot of contracting. And then I dropped that when I shifted to doing a lot more painting. So that was a shift, and it was a difficult shift because when you get really positive feedback about work that you're doing, why would you go do something else? Mm-hmm. You know, if someone's really like blowing smoke and you're feeling good, like to try something that's really unknown and different. Before I did these little sculptures, I was doing for about 3 or 4 months, and I'm still doing them, abstracts. And I really never did anything that didn't have a figure of some sort in it. Mm. And so to put stuff out there that is completely abstract and it's a little scary. There's a little bit of anxiety. But if I could let go of it, which I was able to, and put it out there, then I get feedback. And the feedback helps... channel my creativity in ways that's functional. And in the bigger picture, when you think about community organizations, you think about school systems, you think about not-for-profits, you think about government, many systems are doing things like they've always done them. And I think what's been mentioned here is like being on the edge of the unknown as a system and as members of that system to explore doing something a little different that might be more functional to a context which has changed dramatically. When you think about transportation, we have a system that's, you know, almost barely, it's based on automobiles. So we gave up early on train. And so are we willing to perhaps as a society explore the possibility of developing mass transit that would be functional for a great number of people for a whole host of reasons, economic, developing more equality among disparate groups. I mean, there's a whole host of things, but I think we'd all have to like stand on the edge and say, okay, we're willing to try this. And creativity, I think, has a role to play in developing pathways to connectivity, which are essential for people to, as a group, risk losing whatever advantage they might have as individuals to try something that might benefit us all as a group.
Yeah, certainly Hudson has seen, and many cities and communities have seen that, especially transportation, that the change from the horse and walking and wagons to get around and trains. And Hudson used to have a trolley going up and down Warren Street to, like a bus, and now we have primarily cars is, like you say, Tom, the primary source of getting around. But so but walking is still with us, and I think Hudson sometimes struggles with wayfinding and how when you're walking is, you know, where do you think you're going, and when you get there, what are you going to find? And so that sometimes is a challenge for any community is how to draw people to a destination. And we have a lot of wonderful destinations like our waterfront.
Yeah, it's an amazing spot. And I think wayfinding is an interesting, it's certainly something that could be improved a lot here in the city of Hudson. I think there's, from a governmental standpoint, I think it's interesting to decide like what is sort of worthy of a wayfinding notation. Mm. And I think there's like a lot of, that's like, there's a lot of interesting questions around that about like where should we be sending people and or how should we be sending people? But I think, and also you can't have, there's some element of like, you can't have too many signs at some point. You have so many signs that become meaningless is also. Mm. So I think there are some questions around, do you need a uniform sign policy because you want things to look all the same? Or do you want to sort of embrace a more chaotic system of wayfinding that is arguably more creative, but then could become more confusing if there's different standards? And then is there some sort of gatekeeper, like who gets to decide, who gets to decide what kind of wayfinding do you have? And I think then you also have these like historic preservation policies, aside from like the government wayfinding, is an individual allowed to put a certain kind of sign on their own property? And how does that, what is that tension between an individual's sort of expression, whether it's commercial or not, versus like a community's idea of expression and what would be considered compatible with like the community character.
Well, I like your process of pilot program. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's ways we can experiment. And Chris, you've been involved with our waterfront. And waterfronts have become more friendlier, where they used to be, you know, the other side of the track. Where industry was always taking place, and people didn't put a lot of importance at being at our waterfront except for commercialization. But a lot of towns, especially up and down the Hudson River, have lost their industry and have been struggling to find the usefulness of their waterfronts.
Well, what you're seeing is, so part of creativity is also getting inspiration from others. And so if you look at Athens, you look at Catskill, you look at Poughkeepsie. Just recently, Troy has decided that they're going to not allow reindustrialization of their waterfront. Mm. So we have a lot of examples on the Hudson River of municipalities that have done a really nice job with the waterfront and made it a centerpiece so it becomes an economic, environmental, recreational asset. And so that is, I think, the creative challenge that is ahead for Hudson, personally. There are many challenges that we have. I don't want to in any way belittle affordable housing, but I think that could be part of the waterfront challenge. But the question is, how are we going to develop this in such a way? And I feel that the first step is inspiring people to get down there. So it comes right back to Michael, mm-hmm. who was like, here we have a group of people having a beautiful game of pickup soccer. And you have people who are crossing lines, meeting each other, people that they might never have met otherwise. If we could inspire people to get down to the waterfront and use it in that way, that is going to spark some creativity into new ideas and new ways so that we could find perhaps a more creative and more interesting way to create our own waterfront.
We only have a couple hundred yards of waterfront. So Michael's going to be leaving us now. He has an engagement that he's going to. Thank you, Michael Chimitas, for being involved in this conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, and it's great to see you all.
Good thanks, Michael.
You, okay. Yep. See you all later.
We'll miss you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, one of the things, my wife grew up in Poughkeepsie. Mm. So her family also grew up in Poughkeepsie. So that goes back about 100 years, and it's really changed. You think about the walkway over the huts. Now that was a really great creative idea that
brilliant
that came up with, and it really was over successful in a way that, you know, they didn't anticipate, because that trestle, that railroad bridge, caught on fire at some point in the mid-20th century, and because it was primarily wood, and they thought, you know, this whole thing should come down. But, you know, to take down a huge structure like that is very costly and difficult. So they came up with this great idea.
And I understand it's the second most visited tourist site in New York State outside of New York City. And I've got to think that that's second to Niagara Falls.
Mm.
So people don't realize just how successful the walkway is.
And now we have our Rip Van Winkle Bridge that bridges the two famous Hudson Valley River artists, Thomas Cole and Frederick Church, which is, it's always been there, but to bring attention to it brings people as a destination, and also being more aware of the Hudson Valley and art and tourism. And so there's a lot of possibilities that are just going to keep going, hopefully.
But are we in a creative hotspot? And I think the answer is an emphatic yes.
Yes, I agree.
I think that this they call this America's first canvas.
Mm.
I think there's absolutely no coincidence that people like you, Chad, and people like you, Tom, and so many other artists, my partner's also a visual artist, so many are here. So the question is there something inherently creative about the area? And certainly, I would have to say the nature is very inspiring, but so the challenge is, how do we tap into that creativity and keep it going, especially for the art community?
It's knowing your resources, and what works, and what you visualize is something that has potential and should stay the same. And I think, you know, our agriculture, our river, you know, nature is can't go without nature, and the inspiration and what it gives, and I think art gives. Does art take? Or does it always give?
I wish it would take more. No, I'm just kidding. I think that it's a give and take. The way I see art elementally is communication. And it's a communication that transcends language. If it's effective, connects human beings viscerally through the it demonstrates shared experience, and then through that shared experience, you know, that piece of art, whether it's music or visual or a piece of writing, it's more than the sum of its parts in that connection between the artist and the person that has an experience of it. And so in that way, it is a community builder and a developer. And in this community, the question that I oftentimes think about, having been here for almost 7 years now, is how art can facilitate community growth that benefits each segment of the population, and connects us more across whatever boundaries are keeping us apart. So there's numerous challenges. Art, when you say, does art give or does art take? Oftentimes, when you the scenario is artists go into a place where they can afford, it becomes a place where people go and buy, and it becomes expensive, and then artists can't live there anymore, and they go to the next place. Mm-hmm. So artists create their own condition for their inability to live someplace just economically. Mm-hmm. But the consequences of that are less severe than for the population who might be here generationally. And because of that development, and because they don't get connected to it, become marginalized in it. And that, you know, communities shift all the time. But the ways in which we could be more mindful and intentional about the way we allow development to happen so that we all can participate in how the benefits accrue to different communities, I think, is an important community priority, and I think creativity has a role to play in that.
When you were mentioning language and communication, I think of those as basically the same thing, that language could be a handshake, a smile, looking someone in the eyes, you know, when you're walking down the street. You're communicating a language to say, hello, I'm friendly. I see you as being someone who's friendly. All of a sudden that lifts the individual up, which I think lifts the community up. And I think that's a very important aspect to community, is to create a safe place to live and to work. And when we're talking about pilot programs of things, let's try something different, and let's, for the betterment of society and community. You know, that's, I like that as a goal, and I think some people get beaten down so often they think, never is something good going to happen to me, and that we need to find ways to make that happen. Even a smile, a touch, is language and communication to say, you're in a good place. And then to encourage people to think, and say that it's okay to think and to make and fail, because failure can be devastating, but let's not think of it as the end all.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about empowerment, and I think that in this sense, I think art is foundational and crucial, because I think before we can solve the big problems, affordable housing, gentrification, things that are really, really threatening Hudson, and not just Hudson, the whole Hudson Valley, to be honest, we have entire communities and groups of people who do not feel empowered to be part of the conversation. And art is a way of breaking that barrier and giving people voice. And so I think that that's really interesting. What you're saying is, it does. It starts with a smile. It starts with a touch. It starts with a, I'm going to listen to what you have to say. And I think people underestimate the power of art. But the reality is that art wakes people up and gets people talking. And that empowers voices. And what we need to solve the problems now is more voices, not fewer.
That's the creativity. You know, transcending the traditional ideas that I spoke about in the beginning. Empowering, like you say, Chris. You know, how do we do that? I mean, we had to bring up some local politics, we had a very great, a very good idea, which has been kicked around for a long time, which is basically how to make our community better, how to make it a good place for as many people as possible to want to live here, to want to work here, to raise children, improve our educational system, have a place to play, like Michael was talking about the waterfront and for, you know, children, but, you know, not just children, but people of all ages and just everybody. That's our goal. And how we go about it sometimes can ruffle feathers, because just like anything, the loudest voice usually can be overpowering for people who don't have or don't know how to have a voice.
But here's the parallel with art, is that an artist is putting their neck on the line all the time, especially if there's anything controversial. So, Tom, you were talking about doing something that was different, didn't have figurative, was more abstract. And of course, there is a little bit of anxiety in putting that out. But I would say that a lot of artists, almost anything that they do, is putting their neck on the line. And so the same thing that you're talking about here is, we need people to get out there and put their neck on the line and say something. If we just all sit and just accept, well, this is the way it's been done forever, then the community is not going to progress in any way. But if we approach this as, let's empower people to talk, let's listen to their voices, and to Michael's point, pilot projects. You know, that's a good idea. Let's start that on a small scale, and if it works, we'll expand it out. That's a way that you can transform, as opposed to just everybody sitting back and being afraid to put their neck out. So giving people the ability to say, that's a crazy idea. It's so crazy, it just might work. Let's talk about this.
Don't be afraid. as you say, Chris, and Tom, too, I mean, creating a piece of art just takes to do it. You know, whether it's putting Crayola to a piece of paper or a paintbrush or a camera, and just to do it, that should be the first step, not be afraid to do that. And then, you know, for an artist, of course, we have to make a living. So I know, especially myself and other artists, I know almost nobody who makes a total living off of their art. And I think that's actually our community. There are a lot of people who have multiple jobs, and that's just not artists. That's our economy. And that's strength from an individual. And I think that can be passed along and encouraged with people who don't think, I can make it, I'm not making my bills. Well, let's figure out what you can do to maybe make some more money. That's community problems are our own problems. And I wish, like Chris, like you say, we could somehow share that. And I think social media has been one of those ways to communicate. I'll say Facebook, because that seems to be the most popular, but it's like a community board, a bulletin board, with conversation back and forth, which can help and not.
Well, I was really struck by how active people in the Hudson Valley are on social media in different community board and groups. And as you say, could be quite functional to start communications around issues, develop connectivity, to create to sort of create the electronic beginning of a real connection. I met a number of people over the course of my time here that I had befriended on Facebook for the purpose of doing my business, like art, the gallery, and also connecting to the people in the community. And a number of times people came up to me and said, hi, I'm so-and-so, we're friends on Facebook. And I'm like, oh, your profile picture is a cat, so I don't recognize you. What's your name? But I thought it was a start of at least 8 to 10 connections that I made that I might not have met those people, or I found out what they do. A number of them are artists in their own right, and so I become more aware of the different artists and cultural opportunities in the city. So just creating community through those connections on social media, as much as a waste of time as social media can be, it's really can be very functional to promote not only my art, but connection to the community.
I was having a conversation with a couple people last week about how Hudson has changed, and I've only been here 13 years and have seen it evolve and devolve. You know, it's all good. And Tom, you live in Hudson, and so you're often in groups talking to people all the time, you know, whether they're locals or they're not locals. My feeling was that was more, at least my experience, that was more common, let's say, 10 years ago than it is now. But I think is it changing, or has it always been that way?
Well, I've been here 6 years, going on 7, so my experience is a little shorter than yours. But I do remember when I first came up here, the guys who own my building and with whom I'm in partnership in this project, and they suggested for me to come up. I would come up on the weekends just to do work in the building and see if this is a town that I connected with. And I'd go to the local bookshop beer place because I could drink a beer and read a book and not really feel bad about, you know, being this antisocial person, but nobody ever let me read. They, you know, a number of people were, you know, curious about, you know, about what I'm doing there and who I was. And there seems to be here, much more than in most places I've lived, a desire to connect and create community. And I become much more social for myself as a result of that. And, like, I have to be social for my work. So I have the skills to do that. But for myself, I'd probably not do that. But because of my experience at Hudson, I'm much more willing and enjoy, like, creating connections with new people and maintaining connections with people in the community who seem to have more time and energy to do that than in most places that I've lived in. So I find, especially among creative people, there's a real desire to create, you know, those little small creative communities, but they're also very much interested in being part of the larger community and impactful.
Chris, how do you see yourself in Hudson?
Well, I actually grew up in Columbia County. I grew up in Ankrumdale first and then Copake. And then I moved away. I lived abroad for a little bit. I've been in Brooklyn for many, many years, and I loved it. But I realized that if I wanted to make a difference in Brooklyn, I could speak up at meetings. I could say anything I want. I could write op-eds, and you basically get lost in the shuffle. So it's been very surprising coming back home and living in Hudson. It's been a couple years now to find out that people do want to connect. There's a lot of passion in this town, and you actually can make a case. Now, you talk about creativity and you talk about the process and social media is both good and bad, and that's true, but part of the creative process is dealing with the unpleasantness too. And what I mean by that is we can't always agree on everything. So you're never going to get onto Facebook and you're going to find that everybody has the exact same opinion. In fact, I lived in San Francisco for a few years and I was completely bored because I felt like there was not a lot of diversity. Everybody had the same opinion on everything. And maybe that's a mischaracterization, but that's how I felt as a New Yorker. So to come to Hudson and realize that people, even though they may disagree with you, that they have the passion to argue their case. So the question I think with social media is, yes, sometimes there are conversations that are difficult to have, maybe even a little unpleasant. But if people can do it in a meaningful way, without hate speech, without name calling, without dismissing the other person and listen, that's a real start. And I feel like that's something that's happening in Hudson that is not happening in Brooklyn, where everybody is. You have no, New York City, you have such a small voice. Whereas in Hudson, you know, we really can make a difference and you're seeing people. I'm so inspired by so many people in our community who have made a difference, whether it's a literacy project or whether it's public art like Tom or Michael serving. And that's part of our strength, I think, is the ability to get out there, put your neck on the line, maybe have an unpleasant conversation here or there, but ultimately come together, come up with a solution, and do something different.
I definitely think that's possible, but it's hard to get past maybe traditional feelings that maybe you grew up with or influenced by. And the idea, I think, now is hopefully the influence is more open. And we've always lived in an open society. It's just, I think now it's time to shake hands and say it's okay. You know, you have that point of view, which I don't agree with, and I have my point of view that you don't agree with. But what we can agree on, and there are always things that can be agreed upon by both parties.
The common ground. The common ground's the hard part. It's a really difficult part, but it's worth the effort to get there.
Definitely. And I see that in our community. It's great to have a common council and multiple committees and multiple projects and, I mean, multiple things that are going on that allows all members of the community to be involved in some way or form. One of the great things, you know, when I think about communication that Hudson has that I pay attention to are business signs. I'm always looking at the creativity behind, you know, someone's sign and the way they name their businesses. I love that creativity. I definitely see that versatility here in Hudson. Good for you all, you business owners and artists.
Well, when I moved here, the guys who owned the building said we should name it 46 Green Street Studios because that way people will find it.
Hmm.
And when I told people in town where we were on Green Street, they said, oh, you mean 9? So
Route 9, yeah.
So I didn't know that, and we didn't know that. So the very uncreative name of our business doesn't work for locals.
Although it should.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah. So we're coming up on...
Hello, this is Mr. Petey Pete, and you are listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 and WGXC.org, streaming all over the world.
Lucy Lyon, the king of beasts.
Music from elsewhere and beyond.
Huge elephant trumpet across the plains.
Imaginary soundtracks to unmade foreign films.
And there are rhinos. Those craggy creatures surviving from a bygone age.
Snack Point Charlie. Hosted by Jeff Economy. Every first Wednesday from 10 p.m. to midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Green and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Will Ostro of Catskill, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Green and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
Radio broadcast, this I believe.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here.
Sarah Captain is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Green County lawmakers last week approved upgrades to a cell tower intended to improve communications for first responders. The new tower will be installed in Twilight Park, a historic district in Haines Falls. Lawmakers approved the first stage of the project at the cost of just under $94,000. The County Department of Emergency Services switched over to the new system last week. Emergency Manager Specialist Daniel King said by using high-band frequencies, radio coverage has improved greatly in the county. He said the upgrade services will help everyone. King said, and I quote, people will have better cell coverage when they call 911, end quote.
AT&T and Sprint will lease the tower, with Verizon expected to join in 2020. The upgrade cost a total of about $2 million. Emergency medical services and law enforcement are already using the new radio system. King said fire departments will make the switch on October 9th. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
On September 26th, the Save Curryville activist group says it will present its appeal against the Copaig Zoning Board of Appeals at that board's September meeting. The group's main argument is against Code Enforcement Officer Lee Himes' July 1st decision that GRJH's special use permit for its proposed gas station had not expired. Save Curryville also believes the ZBA should rescind its negative declaration pursuant to SEAKER. GRJH wants to put a gas station and convenience store on a 1.7-acre parcel at the intersection of Route 7 and Route 23. Currently, the public comment period on the project is still open before the Copaig Planning Board. But the next meeting, October 3rd, the Copaig Zoning Board of Appeals meets at 7 p.m. September 26th at the Copaig Town Hall.
Joffrey Wilson and Caitlin Cordero are reporting for the Poughkeepsie Journal. The New York State Bridge Authority is expected to implement a toll hike on all Hudson River crossings next year, but the amount of the increase is still unknown. The authority would also switch to cashless tolling as part of a plan to implement a $243 million capital improvement project, which focuses on maintenance for its bridges throughout 2024. Chris Kelly, acting chief of staff with the Bridge Authority, said, and I quote, "We get it. It will be an inconvenience, but once we're done with that, that span is good for 25 to 30 years, allowing us to push back into regular maintenance," end quote. The Bridge Authority maintains the Mid-Hudson Bridge, the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, the Kingston-Rhinecliff Bridge, the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, and the Bear Mountain Bridge. Each bridge carries the same tolls, $1.50 cash and $1.25 for Easy Pass holders. Kelly said about 95% of the authority's revenue comes from tolls. The rate changes will likely be decided in 2020. Read the full story in the Poughkeepsie Journal.
Emil Munson reports in the Albany Times-Union that New York Senator and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer sent a strongly worded letter to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on September 23rd. Schumer did not use the word impeachment, but did call for an investigation into President Donald Trump's actions toward Ukraine. Trump admitted September 22nd that he asked a Ukrainian leader to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden. Quote, "The Republican Senate's see no evil, hear no evil attitude towards such a serious national security concern is unacceptable and must change," unquote, Schumer wrote in the letter. Read more about this story in the Albany Times-Union.
The Daily Freeman is reporting the Bard Center for the Study of Hate has received a $165,000 grant from the GS Humane Corp to fund five projects over the next 2 years. The center is a part of the Human Rights Project at Bard College. The projects to be funded by the grant will support research, ideas, and direction for people and groups seeking to combat hate and its manifestations. The GS Humane Corp aims to, and I quote, "enable organizations to educate communities on the humane treatment of all living beings and to assist with the achievement of this outcome," end quote. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman.
Sarah Trafton reports for Columbia Green Media that Greene County Industrial Development Agency Executive Director Renee Van Schack said September 23rd that the IDA is talking with a company about putting a, quote, "higher quality hotel," unquote, on Route 23A near Exit 21 of the New York State Thruway. The IDA tore down the former Quality Inn there earlier this year. Van Schack would not reveal the name of the hotel chain or developer. By comparison, quote, "the Quality Inn was considered economy class," unquote, Van Schack said. Quote, "upper mid-class would be a Hampton Inn, for example," unquote. And he claims the new hotel will not just be better, but also bigger, with 85 to 100 rooms. Catskill Town Supervisor Doreen Davis said she is excited about a hotel opening in her town. Quote, "not only does it encourage tourist visitors, but also business travelers who will stop and contribute to our economy. A hotel property would make use of our new sewer infrastructure. The more utilization by New Yorkers, the more costs are shared," unquote, she said. Read more about this at HudsonValley360.com.
Bethany Bump is reporting in the Times Union. The nurses at Albany Medical Center are planning to picket the hospital September 25th to draw attention to what they say are unsafe staffing levels at the facility. The hospital currently has almost 200 nursing positions open. This will be the first picket line at Albany Med since nursing.